Chewy was the last of the group to come down the drill hole. The others had already made at least a little progress in exploring the tunnels. They were identical in design to the Corellian ones, big, square in cross-section, cut out of the living rock. But the walls and floors of these tunnels were cracked and broken, and there were signs that the tunnel had flooded repeatedly over the years. Q9 extruded a pair of floodlights from his topside dome. One he directed at the ceiling to provide general lighting, the other he aimed through the direction of his forward travel. Ebrahim had worried that the children might be afraid in the dark, forbidding tunnels, but he soon realized that he had underestimated them. They were clearly very used to dealing with odd circumstances. Jaina and Jason were encouraging Anakin to reach out with the Force and see if he could find anything like the whatever it was he had detected in the Corellian tunnels.
"I can sort of feel it,"
Anakin said a bit doubtfully. He reached out his hand and seemed to be trying to catch something floating in the air.
"Not as strong as the other place, not sharp, just sort of floating there, like it got broke."
"Excuse me, perhaps I can be of help. Duchess Marcha, you believe that the entrance to this chamber will be in exactly the same position relative to the entrance as the one on Corellia?"
"That is correct."
"Then I can use my inertial tracking data to lead us to the proper coordinates. I should be able to get us within 30 meters of the correct point."
Anakin nodded eagerly.
"Get me that close, and I can find it."
Three times Q9 stopped abruptly at cross corridors and dove down side passages. Twice he came back. The third time, it would seem, he found the path he was looking for. The two Drawl had the hardest time keeping up with the others. The children could climb over anything, and Chewbacca could walk faster than anyone else in the group could run. Ebrahim and Marcha puffed along as best they could, trying to keep up. They made the left turn and came around the corner just in time to see the Wookiee and the children making a right down the next corridor. The two Drawl redoubled their efforts, but they were just barely able to keep Q9 from getting farther ahead. The children, however, were actually closing the distance with Q9 as Anakin grew more eager in the chase, and the two other children urged him on.
"Keep trying, Anakin,"
Jaina shouted as her brother paused for a moment, looking a little lost. Anakin nodded, then pointed his finger at something invisible under the floor.
"Can you feel it now?"
Jason called to his brother as he climbed over a pile of collapsed rock.
"Can you?" "Yeah, starting to. It's there, in the floor, just like in the other place." "Q9, stop!"
Anakin called.
"You're going too far."
The droid turned around and managed to blind everyone for a moment as his forward view floodlight swept across their eyes.
"Q9, shut that thing off,"
Ebrahim shouted.
"There."
Anakin pointed at a blank spot on the muddy wall.
"Someone lit me up and... ugh."
Anakin got the wind knocked out of him as Chewbacca scooped him up in his arms. Anakin pushed in on a section of caked-on mud until he found a small grid of buttons that flickered to life when he pushed one of them. Anakin frowned at the buttons. He punched a combination and waited a few seconds for something to happen. Nothing did. He balled up his fist and punched the top of the keypad. Some green light buttons came on more brightly and stayed on. Anakin tried the combination again, and this time something very definitely happened. Suddenly, the muddy overlayer of the wall shuddered and fell off in a heap, splattering everyone with dirt. The stone wall under the mud dropped down into the floor. Behind the false wall was a panel, tarnished and mottled. A line appeared in it and formed into a seam. Suddenly, there was an enormous door in the wall, and it swung open. Behind the door was a long silver corridor, exactly like the one on Corellia. Anakin was in motion as soon as the Wookiee put him down. The corridor ended in open space, and they found themselves standing on a platform that jutted out into nothingness. There were no guardrails of any kind. The cavern was an exact duplicate of the one hidden away on Corellia. It was in the shape of a sharply angled cone, about a half kilometer tall, all the surfaces made of the same silvery metal. All of a sudden, the viewing platform started moving up, sidling up the side of the cone toward its apex. Anakin had found another concealed keypad, this one set in the surface of the platform itself. He was kneeling over it, punching in commands. The platform stopped, then moved sideways. It seemed as if it were still attached to the wall of the chamber, but how, Ebrahim could not tell. The two simply flowed into each other. They heard a low, solid boom coming from the corridor, and Ebrahim realized that the outer door to the tunnel system had just closed itself. Then the silver walls of the cone puckered in around the corridor opening to seal it off. Almost immediately, the platform started moving again, sliding smoothly and perfectly up the side of the conical chamber.
Anakin!
Aunt Marcia shouted.
What on earth are you doing? Stop this platform at once!
Ebrahim made a move as if to try and stop him, but Jason held up a warning hand.
Don't. Whatever he's doing it and doing it right. If you try and interrupt him and he gets confused and pushes the wrong button...
Ebrahim saw Jason's point. What if Anakin accidentally pushed a button that made the platform vanish altogether? Up and up they went, the far sides of the cone coming closer and closer.
We are going to be mashed flat in a moment,
Q9 announced. Perhaps 20 meters short of the top, the platform stopped. And something happened to the top of the cone. It shimmered and its surface rippled and wiggled, then began pulsing upward.
It's like it was pushing,
Dana said.
As if it was trying to get...
And with a thunderous roar, the pulsating point of the cone rammed upward and broke free. Suddenly, they could see the night sky above. Loose rock and debris fell down into the chamber. But a strange flicker of power, there was no clearer way to describe it, swept past the platform they stood on, grabbed at the debris, and threw it back upwards, out of the hole and up into the night. All was abruptly quiet and still. Where the point of the cone had been, there was now a perfect cylinder, precisely the diameter of the platform they stood on. Anakin pushed another button, and the platform moved upward again. Then it reached the surface and stopped. They were standing in the dark on a silver disk on the surface of Dral, looking up at a cold night sky pocked with stars, Talus and Tralis visible near the horizon.
What is this place? Ebrahim asked.
I can answer that, nephew. This place is a repulsor. A planet-sized repulsor. Powerful enough to move the whole world of Dral. It did move the world of Dral once long ago.
But I don't get it,
Jason objected.
What do you mean the repulsors moved the planet? Moved it from where?
Another star system. Scientists have argued for generations that the Corellian planetary system could not have formed naturally. That someone must have moved all these planets here from elsewhere. Well, here at last is the proof. We know there is an identical device on Corellia. There must also be installations on Salonia and Talus and Tralis.
Aunt Marcia shook her head thoughtfully.
And we Drow thought we knew our past.
But why has everyone been searching like crazy for these things?
Jason said. It's interesting and important, but why would guys like the Drawlists and the Human League be looking for ancient machines? They don't care about that kind of stuff.
No,
agreed the Duchess Marcia.
But they do care about weapons. A repulsor that can move a planet can also move a spacecraft. Or smash it to pieces. It is a massively powerful defensive weapon. With a planetary repulsor operational, a planet could hold off any conceivable attack.
...30 seconds to projected edge of interdiction field.
The tactics officer's voice echoed through every compartment of the Intruder, the Bakuran light cruiser that would serve as Luke's flagship on this mission. Luke and his companions were strapped into their seats and ready for action.
20 seconds.
I don't know why they bothered with a countdown clock, Lando said. That's just a best guess estimate of the edge of the field. It's bound to be off.
It never hurts to give the crew something to focus on, said Admiral Ossilage. And it makes it a great deal easier to coordinate between the four ships.
10 seconds.
Luke looked over at the tactical display showing the colored dots of the intruder and the three destroyers, Watchkeeper, Sentinel, and Defender, all modified to go through an interdiction field. They were moving toward the dotted blue line of the field's estimated limit.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Nothing happened. But then Luke hadn't really expected it to.
Hey, who knows? Lando asked. Maybe they dropped the field. Maybe we can do this the easy...
Luke was slammed forward into his restraint harness and thrown to one side at the same time.
We are in the interdiction field. Maintaining static hyperspace bubble. First static bubble generator decaying at expected rate. Collapse imminent.
The whole ship buckled and shuddered as the first bubble generator blew out and the second cut in. The second generator blew and the third snapped on.
Maintaining hyperspace bubble.
There was no doubt about it. Each bounce in and out of hyperspace was a bit less violent than the one before it. That shock was the hardest yet, and suddenly the ship's artificial gravity cut out just as the lights died again. The ship began to tumble end over end as new alarms began to blare and honk. The red emergency lights came on, revealing a scene of chaos. Two or three bridge officers had been thrown clear of their stations and were flailing about in midair. Dozens of small objects had been thrown loose by the impact as well, and they were caroming about the interior of the bridge.
Main power coupling offline. We have lost positive ship control, but hyperspace bubble is holding.
Ocelich punched the comm key that linked him to the ship's master.
Captain Semak, cut the hyperspace sustainer. Drop us into normal space at once.
A moment later, the star lines flared almost half-heartedly to life before dying out, leaving the stars of Corellia gently pinwheeling as the intruder tumbled her stately way across the sky. The gravitics came on again, and the debris caught in midair started floating downward, thudding and clattering to the deck as weight returned. The flag deck technician announced that three of the ships had made it through.
We are not receiving any comm or data link from Watchkeeper, she reported to Captain Ocelich. She is tumbling badly, sir.
Tried to ride the hyperdrive sustainer a little too long, it would appear, Ocelich said. Very well. Use laser visual signaling to order ships to rendezvous at Watchkeeper.
Han sat back in his flight chair, immensely restless. Watching Salkul do a semi-competent job of flying her ship was not likely to do his mood much good. The cone ship had already suffered two propulsion failures, and Han had been drafted to perform repairs both times, and what he saw of the propulsion systems in the process had not put him at his ease. It seemed the whole sublight propulsion system was held together with spit and string. Nor had Drachmas, serving as the ship's commander, shown the best judgment. She had ordered three evasive course changes in response to what seemed to be wholly imaginary threats from the handful of craft that were braving the spaceways. Given the extremely limited capacity of the cone ship's sensors, there seemed very little point to any attempt at evasive maneuver. The only ships they could detect were the ones moving very slowly and not very far away. Nor could the cone ship run fast if she were attacked. And she could not shoot at all. Unless they were attacked by an overburdened space tug, they were fair game for anyone. There was, therefore, very little point in trying to stay out of sight. Drachmas, however, was not convinced by these arguments. It was starting to sink in with Han that the Salonians might be the masters of the underworld, but they needed a little practice to get good at ship handling. Maybe he should take a little nap. He was just on the verge of closing his eyes when the alarms blew. He was halfway out of his restraint harness, about to rush to battle stations, when it dawned on him that he had no battle station on this boat. Out in the corridor, he saw that Drachmas had materialized out of her stateroom.
What is it?
She called to Southgold.
Detector alert. Another ship. No, three. No, four others. They just popped out of hyperspace.
But what about the interdiction field? Han protested.
It's still there, but the ships got through it somehow. They're flying straight at us and Salonia.
For evasive,
Drachmas ordered at once.
Wait! Hold it!
Han shouted. But it was too late. Salkrul slammed the sublight engines up to maximum and heeled the nose of the ship hard over.
Don't throttle up so hard. Your power relay inverters can't handle too many hard power-ups.
And the sickening thud they heard a moment later told Han he had understated the case. The inverters could not handle any more hard power-ups.
You've blown the primary power regulator. Throttle down before you lose the backup, too.
Salkrul needed no more convincing. She lunged for the controls and pulled the throttle back. Nothing happened. The ship continued to accelerate wildly.
Backup regulator's blown!
Han scrambled out of his flight chair and dove for the access ladder to the lower deck. He spent a frantic moment or two searching through the mishmash of non-standard components for the manual emergency cutoff switch, spotted it, and yanked it down hard. The sublight engines died with a sickening lurch. A moment's examination confirmed his worst fears. The power coupling runaway had blown the sublight engine initiator. He climbed back up the ladder. Salkrul checked the displays.
Uh-oh. The Navic computer just crashed.
Look on the bright side. If we can't navigate, it doesn't matter if the propulsion system is melted down to slag. After leaving Corellia, Leia had wanted to fly directly to Dral to check on the children. Mara wanted to get back to Corellia because she had business interests there. Since neither woman could persuade the other, they had compromised and were now heading to Salonia. The Jade's fire was farther sunward from Salonia than Salkul's cone ship was at that moment, but she had far better detectors and a far better stealth ability than the cone ship. The Jade's fire could see the cone ship, but the cone ship could not see the fire. Beyond that, the Jade's Fire also had a far superior database. The cone ship had spotted the sudden arrival of four large incoming blips. The Jade's Fire had them nailed as Bakurin warships.
What the hell are they doing here? Mara asked. And how did they beat the interdiction field? And who's aboard?
I don't know how they got here, Leia replied, but I'm glad to see them. And as for who is aboard, I think I have a very good idea. She reached out with her force sense and closed her eyes.
Luke. Luke is there.
I knew that when I saw that the ships were Bakurin.
Now then, the first order of business is fleet status, Belindi Kalenta said to the staff assembled on the flag deck of the intruder. The Bakurins had brought along special instruments for the purpose of tracking the field, and she had been studying them in order to give a report. Watchkeeper has managed to restore her life support systems and her attitude control, but she has not been able to restore her propulsion system. We plan to launch an uncrewed shuttle vehicle loaded with spare parts toward her as we come in on closest approach.
Anything further on what we'll be up against? Lando asked.
We are seeing small fighter craft launching from the Double Worlds, from Corellia and Dral, all headed for a very clear intercept point directly in our path for Salonia. We can assume the Salonians will launch their own craft when we are closer. It seems clear that craft from all the planets are joining in a coordinated attack. You were right, Admiral Osilich. We are learning things from this assault. On another subject, I can now report that we pinpointed the exact source of the jamming in the interdiction field. Both are coming from Center Point Station. It is a very large space station that sits at the barycenter or balance point between the double worlds of Talus and Trellis. Center Point is comparable in size to a Death Star, and I believe much more massive. And it seems to be putting out one hell of a lot of power. Our tracking isn't absolutely solid at this range, but we are fairly sure that we've also spotted fighters launching from Center Point and heading toward us.
Osilich raised his eyebrows.
Indeed. They chose to send fighters away from what they must defend most strongly. But their failure to defend is only part of the problem. They must also know that even a somewhat coordinated attack demonstrates that the seemingly independent rebel groups are coordinating with each other. The Human League's propaganda goes on and on about how much they hate all the other groups. What does this tell you, Lieutenant Kalenda?
Only that we are missing something,
Something very big.
I quite agree.
Ocelage thought for a moment.
How long until closest approach with Watchkeeper?
Kalenda checked the time. We will do the flyby in about 8 hours, sir.
Very well.
Ocelage stood abruptly and turned to his flag communications officer.
Set up a direct laser line-of-sight link with the captain of the Watchkeeper. Patch it through to my cabin. Full privacy scramble.
Tendra Rezant was close to despair. It seemed as if she had been stuck aboard this ship for years instead of days. Why didn't Lando answer?
Tendra to Lando.
Her taped voice sounded far more sensible than she had felt for a long time.
Please respond on preassigned frequency. Tendra to Lando.
Admiral Hortel Ocelage stood on the flag deck of the intruder.
We have taken the Watchkeeper in tow and transferred virtually all of her crew to the other vessels. You no doubt are wondering why we are taking a near-derelict craft in tow as we enter into battle. I will tell you. I intend to sacrifice her.
If that statement was meant to elicit a general murmur of astonishment, it had its intended effect. Ocelage waited for the room to quiet down.
We have been baffled by the badly timed arrival and inadequate coordination of the opposing fleet. We are now only a few hours away from contact with the first elements of that fleet, and yet the tail end of it has barely begun to form up. I have analyzed the ship placements of the enemy, and they are very bad. If they plan instead to draw us in by offering themselves as a target and then retreating, then they have deployed themselves very well indeed. The obvious question is, of course, draw us in toward what? I intend to find out, and without risking all of my command. We will shortly rig a slave system capable of flying the Watchkeeper by remote control. I will operate the main remotes myself. Let it begin.
He nodded to the intruder's tactical officer.
All crew to battle stations. All fighter pilots to their spacecraft.
Now, Leia thought as she gazed out one of the Jade Fire's viewports. Now they were close enough. At this distance, she could reach across and sense her brother's mind, if indeed he was there. She shut her eyes and used her power in the Force to reach, to spread her senses outward. And she felt him at once, felt him strong and clear across the darkness and the distance. Leia smiled, reveled in the warmth of the contact, of the pleasure of knowing her brother was near and coming closer. But that was only half of it. She knew that Luke would sense her in the Force in the same moment, would instantly know where she was. Even if her ability was not strong enough to allow any meaningful communication, just the simple knowledge that he was there, that he would know she was here, was a tremendous comfort. Luke was halfway up the access ladder of his X-Wing when he felt his sister's touch through the Force. He froze and looked up with his mind's eye through the bulkheads and decks and durasteel of the intruder, up and out into the clean darkness of space. He could see her spirit there, shining in the dark, as clearly as he could see R2 being lowered into his socket on the X-Wing. And now that he was reaching out with his Force sense, he realized there was someone else out there. Han is here too, he thought. Leia and Han are both here. And there isn't a thing I can do about it. Leia felt the same contact, almost by accident, as her Force sense swept across space. Han! She worked the detector controls and brought the sensors to bear on the right piece of sky. There! She pointed to a small blip in the detector display. Han is on that blown-out cone ship. Luke is aboard the largest Bakuran ship, but Han is here too. Strictly speaking, there wasn't really any reason for Lando to run the automatic comm check. Not when all the standard comm systems were shut down by the jamming. He didn't expect any surprises, but What one expected rarely had much to do with what one got.
Tendra to Lando, please respond on pre-assigned frequency.
Lando was stunned. What in the name of stars and skies was Tendra doing here?
Lando replying to Tendra. It's a long story. I have just now received your transmission.
He paused for a moment and then went on, feeling more than a bit awkward.
It might sound melodramatic, but I'm about to go into battle, and there is no time for anything. There's a lot I want to say, but all of it will have to wait.
Han Solo was not a happy man. There are few things to make a pilot feel as helpless as being aboard a derelict ship. He stared at the ruined initiator, doing his best to memorize it before he touched it. He was going to have exactly one chance to repair this thing, and he had to get it right.
Honored Solo!
The voice boomed down from the upper deck, loud enough and suddenly enough that Han nearly jumped out of his skin.
Drachmas, don't do that! I could have snapped the impeller bracket clean off if I'd been touching it.
My apologies, Honored Solo, but a ship is about to dock with us.
What?
Han forgot all about the initiator and scrambled up the ladder to the upper deck. He saw from the visual mode display that there was indeed another ship out there, only a half kilometer away and closing fast.
She came up from our stern,
Salkuth said apologetically.
Our stern detectors were never very good, and the overload must have damaged them some way the diagnostics couldn't spot.
But what do we do, Honored Solo?
Drachmas asked.
What can we do? We have no comm system with the jamming, so we can't talk with them. We have no propulsion system, so we can't move unless we all get out and push. All we can do is put out the welcome mat and hope they're friendly.
Han stopped talking and looked harder at the incoming ship.
Wait a second.
I know that ship. He heard the thud of hull clamps linking to the cone ship, and the high-pitched hum of a force field coming on between the two airlocks, allowing free transit from one ship to the other.
That's the Jade's fire that just latched itself to our hull. Mara Jade's ship. Your swell friend has just tracked me, or you, or us, halfway across the Corellian system.
The inner airlock door slid open, and Han stood there, open-mouthed in shock. Leia Organa Solo wrapped her arms around her husband. Hello, Han. I missed you. Luke Skywalker flew his X-Wing in formation with the Lady Luck, both craft flying escort on the intruder. The four ships of the Bakuran Task Force were set in a pyramid with the Watchkeeper at the leading point. The hope was that the opposition would not be able to detect the tractor beams the three other ships were using to hold Watchkeeper in formation.
Luke, come in, Luke.
It was Lando on the line-of-sight laser comm system. You're breaking up a bit, Lando. What's up?
I just wanted to know if you had any better idea what we're looking for out there.
In other words, Lando wanted to know if Luke had sensed anything through the Force. Not really. Ocelage was right. The enemy formations are all wrong for fighter-to-fighter battle. If that was what this was about, we'd wipe them out in a minute. A wave of Corellian pocket patrol boats came in from somewhere, trying to stay hidden in the glare of Corell, the system's sun. They went straight for the Watchkeeper, but broke off their attack almost before it had started, only getting off a few token turbolaser shots before shifting course and diving away. A flight of Solonian light attack fighters came in right behind the pocket patrol boats and performed almost the identical maneuver, coming in just a trifle closer, and were rewarded by a series of rapid bursts from the Watchkeeper's main battery. The Watchkeeper scored two direct hits on the LAS. Luke had to hand it to Ocelage, who was flying the Watchkeeper by remote. The surviving LAFs moved off on the same heading as the pocket patrol boats on a bearing that would take them just over Solonia. More pocket patrol boats came in from directly above the Bakuran formation, diving straight into the center of the wedge formation to come up behind the Watchkeeper and give her a dose of firepower from the rear. Shooing them away was a job for the fighters, and several flights of Bakuran fighters took up the task. Luke decided to join them. Lando, let's encourage those pocket patrol boats to go on about their business. Form on my port wing and follow me in. the X-Wing dove into the center of the flying wedge, the Lady Luck off her port wing. Luke spotted a pair of pocket patrol boats below and off to starboard. He swooped in on them, locking his guns on them. But both of them blew up before he could even fire.
Scored two. At least I think it was me. A lot of shooting going on. Luke, coming up from the rear and below.
Luke had his X-Wing in a diving barrel roll before he could see the threat. Sure enough, there was a pocket patrol boat and an LAF coming straight for him. Both of the fighters opened up on him, and the X-Wing took a glancing hit to the port side lower wing. The first of Luke's bursts hit the LAF and blew it sky high. The second only caught a piece of the pocket patrol boat and sent it tumbling out of control and out of the fight. Luke pulled the X-Wing's nose up and headed back toward the Watchkeeper, coming up under her keel.
That's it. They've broken off.
Yeah, and they're heading for that same piece of sky as all the other flights bugged out toward. That's where they want us to go.
And that's where we are going. The Watchkeeper's changing course to pursue. Just what Ocelage said they'd want him to do.
Great. But I'm not sure who's outsmarting who in all this. I'm going to fly formation on the Watchkeeper, high and to the rear. Stay with me.
Received and understood.
Watchkeeper broke formation with the other big ships and lumbered toward the massed formations of pocket patrol boats and LAFs.
Luke, another flight of LAFs coming in.
Let them come. I want to see how they respond. Six LAFs came up from behind. Four took a firing pass right over the topside of the Watchkeeper. Explosions flickered and flared over the decks of the Watchkeeper, but her shields held. The main batteries swung about and poured fire at the LAFs. Two of them flew right into the battery fire before the others peeled off and headed for that same slice of sky. The other two LAFs were on them, sweeping past in a blaze of turbolaser fire, catching both ships with repeated hits. But with shields at maximum, the small lasers on the LAFs weren't able to do any appreciable damage. The two LAFs swooped past unmolested and followed their fellows off down the same vector. Suddenly, with no warning at all, a giant, invisible fist slammed into the Watchkeeper. The lower hull slammed upward, pancaking against the upper hull as huge sections of ship flew off into space. Massive explosions ripped through the ship and merged into a single fireball that engulfed it completely. Evasive! Luke flipped his X-Wing around to boost away from the expanding fireball at maximum thrust. The Lady Luck was beside him, matching the X-Wing's acceleration, but the shock wave of the explosion was moving faster. Debris of all sizes clattered into the shield, bouncing the ship around even more. At last, the explosion shock wave was past them, and Luke was able to bring the X-Wing back under control. Lando?
I'm here. What was that?
I don't know. But I've got a very nasty hunch we haven't seen the last of it.
It is as we feared, said Drachmas as she watched the main display aboard the Jade's Fire. The fools have used it.
Used what? Han asked. What was that?
A planetary repulsor.
And Drachmas told them basically the same story that Ebrahim and Aunt Marcia had pieced together after finding the secret installation on Drahl. A huge buried repulsor. That's what the Human League was looking for.
Yes, though they may well have found it by now. The Drahls and the folk of the Double Worlds are searching for their repulsors as well. We Selonians found ours first and quickly made it operational.
We? Han said. Your dens control that thing?
In truth, I am not sure. There are two factions. One, ours, calls itself the Republicanists. We sought to use the repulsors as a bargaining chip. We wish to turn our repulsor over to the New Republic in return for a guarantee of Selonia's sovereignty inside the New Republic and the Corellian sector government. That was why we wanted to bring you to Selonia. Honored Solo. It was hoped that we might use you to open the negotiations.
And the other faction?
Calls itself the Absolutists. Sought to use the repulsor as a weapon to establish absolute Selonian independence. Either side could have used it as a weapon.
But there were fighters from all the Corellian worlds here, Mara objected.
Yes, a huge irony. We have long suspected that all the revolutionary groups were being coordinated by someone outside themselves. We have proof of that now, but we are no closer to knowing who that outside force is.
She looked toward the screen where they had just seen the Bakurin ship destroyed.
All I know for certain is that my planet has just declared war on the New Republic.
The Duchess Marcia of Mastigophorus rode up the strange silver disc elevator to the surface, Anakin at the controls as usual. Down below her, the Millennium Falcon was concealed, and Chewbacca was working Ebrahim and Q-9 and the twins hard, setting up a snug little underground camp in the repulsor chamber. They would be able to hide out there for quite some time to come. But right now, Marcia simply wanted to get out from underground and stand under the bold night sky of Dral. The disc elevator rushed smoothly upward to the apex of the huge chamber, rising out of the ground into a brilliant night, the sky awash with stars. And more than stars. There, off to the east, Corellia and Salonia were two fat points of light near the horizon. And to the west, floating a bit higher in the sky, the double worlds of Talus and Tralis. With Center Point Station so tiny a fleck of light, Marcia was not sure if she saw it or simply imagined that she saw it.
They're out there, somewhere, aren't they?
Anakin asked, taking Marcia by the paw and leaning into her a bit. She wrapped her arm around him.
Yes, dear, they are. Your parents are out there, I am sure of it, working and fighting and struggling to set things right.
Anakin nodded thoughtfully.
They always do. Is that why we have to stay here? So we can help them by figuring out this repulsor thing?
Yes, dear, that's it exactly.
Gee, I sure hope we don't let them down.
Somewhere out on the edges of the Thanta Zilbra system, Wedge Antilles brought his enhanced X-Wing in for a landing on the flight deck of the Narratus, and wished to the devil he had an enemy he could shoot at. Instead, they were evacuating people from a whole star system, just because the paranoids at NRI had heard some crazy rumor that someone had blown up one star and was threatening to blow up Thanta Zilbra next. At least he was flying fighters again. For a while, it had seemed as if he had been drawing every duty but the one he was best at. At least it was nearly over. 0 hour was in less than 12 hours now, and the fleet was supposed to jump into hyperspace no later than 1 hour before then. Another shift and a half, and it would all be over. And more than likely, they'd have to move everyone off the transports back to their homes, with apologies all around for the inconvenience. Of course, a fair number of the people of Thanta Zilbra had saved them the trouble. Unable to believe there was any danger, they had simply refused to go. But enough of all that. He needed to unwind before he went back out. After a shower and change of clothes, Wedge went over to the communications center. Something had happened, and he realized it was not calm that had brought the room to silence, but horror. Everyone in the room was staring at one or another of the monitor displays. Wedge hurried over to the fighter communications station.
Parry, what is it?
He asked the duty officer. Parry shook his head and pointed at the main display screen.
The star. Look at it.
Wedge looked at the infrared image of the star's disk. Only an hour before, it had been a placid, featureless blob with nothing more threatening than a sunspot or two to blemish its appearance. Now it was a roiling, tortured inferno, bubbling over with flares and spicules and prominences, its surface churning violently.
It's going to blow, Wedge said. I don't believe it.
And now, what do we do about all the people who believed as little as we did?
Parry asked.
Wedge stared at the monitor screen and frowned. We have to go back and get them.
Wedge lost count of the number of missions he flew that day. All he could remember later were faces, images, moments. A crying child in her mother's arms. Another baby thrust aboard his craft by a father who could not get aboard himself. The stale smell of too many bodies jammed into too small a space. The stink of fear itself in the air. And then, sitting at the controls of his runabout, asking for launch clearance to go back for the next load, and hearing the request denied, there was no time to go back. At the operations center, they were all watching it. There was nothing else they could do. The cameras from the stay-behind drones were sending their signals via hyperwave link, so Wedge saw it happen. The star seemed to grow darker, shrink in on itself. Its surface seethed with energy, collapsing down on itself until it flared out in a blinding gout of white star fire that bloomed outward, outward, past the incinerating planets, past the vaporized space stations, until it reached the stay-behind camera and... The screen went black. Right on schedule, Harry said half to himself. Bovo Yeagan is next. Estimated system population, 12 million. And they're spread out over two inhabited planets and dozens of stations, asteroids, and habitats. If we couldn't pull 10 or 15,000 people out of this system, what the hell are we going to do there?
I don't know, said Wedge. I don't know.
All he knew for sure was that unless some way could be found to stop the next Nova, millions of people were going to die. To be continued. This is Anthony Heald. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Assault at Salonia by Roger McBride Allen. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Lars Howell. Abridgment by Trevi Johnson. Assault at Salonia is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 1995, all rights reserved. The book Star Wars, Assault at Salonia, Volume 2 of the Corellian Trilogy, is available wherever Bantam books are sold.